G-Force, a kaiju podcast.
G-Force?
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.
Kiss you, guys.
What terrible language!
Calling Monster Island. Calling Monster Island.
And now, your hosts.
One is me. And the other is Godzilla.
Nick and Andrew.
Hello, and welcome to episode 37 of G-Force, a kaiju podcast, a show in which a rotating cast of kaiju enthusiasts gets together every other week to discuss all things kaiju. My name is Nick, and with me is my co-host.
This is Andrew.
And with us we have...
This is Brendan.
And today, the random number generator has, for the first time, picked an American movie for us to discuss, not including the MonsterVerse films, since we picked those ourselves. And that's 2013's Pacific Rim, directed by Guillermo del Toro and written by Travis Beecham and also Guillermo del Toro. Andrew, would you like to give us our synopsis?
On an Earth overrun by kaiju that emerge from a strange rift on the floor of the Pacific, the Breach, giant mechs called Jaegers are humanity's primary line of defense, kaiju-sized robots that can only be operated by pilots drifting together, mingling their minds as one to operate the Jaegers in tandem. Jaeger pilot Raleigh, of the triumphant Gypsy Danger, loses his brother in an engagement with a Category 3 kaiju, and feeling his brother's death through their connection, vows never to let anyone inside his head again. 5 years later, Category 4 kaiju have turned humanity's brief-lived stint of victories around. The giant mechanical warriors can no longer keep pace. Raleigh, now a down-on-his-luck worker, is recruited by Marshal Pentecost, his old commander, to return to the Jaeger program. With the few remaining Jaegers being refit to the newest technological standards, the Marshal believes that a last-ditch strike on the Breach itself may be the only way to save humanity from the ever-escalating strength of each new kaiju. Previous attacks on the Breach have failed, but with Earth on the brink of being overrun, scientist Dr. Gottlieb believes that the increased kaiju traffic will stabilize the Breach long enough to allow passage back in the other direction. The last four Jaegers in service, a rebuilt Gypsy Danger, Australian-built Striker Eureka, China's Crimson Typhoon, and Russia's veteran Jaeger Cherno Alpha, are operating out of the Shatter Dome. And with the Earth's overrun by exponentially closer together kaiju attacks being predicted within a week, Raleigh sets about looking for a co-pilot, with his eyes on Mako Mori, the Marshal's protege. She has ambitions on being a pilot herself, but the Marshal, who's raised her after she was orphaned, believes that her desire for vengeance for the death of her family in a kaiju attack brings emotions too strong for drifting with another pilot, which their near disastrous attempt at drifting confirms, as she's lost in memories of the trauma of the attack that claimed her family. Doctors Gottlieb and Geisler are sent after Hannibal Chow, a black market dealer in kaiju body parts, for a kaiju brain to drift with, in order to gather intelligence on these strange invading beasts. They find that the kaiju are engineered, an extermination force in advance of alien colonists who conquer, use up, and discard planets before moving on to the next one. Soon, a double event occurs, with two Category 4 kaiju, Otachi and Leatherback, emerging to attack Hong Kong. And when Cherno Alpha and Crimson Typhoon are lost, and Striker Eureka disabled by an advanced EMP, Marshal Pentecost is forced to deploy Gypsy Danger, not susceptible to EMPs due to its analog construction, despite its volatile pair of pilots. The duo manage to emerge victorious, but with only Striker Eureka and Gypsy Danger left, the situation is more dire than ever. When three more kaiju emerge shortly thereafter, one a new unprecedented Category 5, the final duo of Jaegers is deployed, with the Marshal taking over for one of Stryker's injured pilots, despite the fact that, due to his failing health, it's a certain suicide mission for him. However, they discover that they can only pass through the rift with a kaiju presence. They'll have to ride one through the rift in order for it to let them pass. With Striker Eureka detonating its nuke to take out the kaiju, Gypsy Danger, itself possessing a nuclear core, leaps into the breach with the corpse of a slain kaiju, with Raleigh ejecting an unconscious Mako to safety, setting the core to detonate as he emerges in an alien world, plummeting through the sky, and evacuates at the last second, riding up through the collapsing breach as the nuke detonates, ending the threat of invasion as he and Mako reunite on the surface of the Pacific.
So what do you guys think of this movie?
I feel like, to me at least, this was a big deal until Godzilla 2014 came out and just kind of erased it from the cultural consciousness. It was the perfect thing for kaiju-starved masses, but when Godzilla himself came back, it was forgotten. The spotlight was just completely yanked off of it. But for a time, it was the perfect snack, the perfect way to scratch the itch. And I think I forgot about it for the same reason. It was a great theatrical experience. I enjoyed it. It was a worthy new entrant into the kaiju genre, but it just got overshadowed by the return of a classic franchise. So for me, this was the first time revisiting it since theaters, and it was interesting to see if it held up or not, which we'll get into in the episode.
I love this movie. I think it is utterly fantastic. There's some stuff that doesn't work, especially upon, well, usually I'd say rewatch, but I've dug it when I rewatched it for the podcast, so that's not true. But I think it's just incredible. To me, this is a film stuff like Godzilla vs. Kong, Final Wars, films like that, dream to be. This like perfect blend of kaiju action with the humanity and heart that is like the center of the genre. I will say this right here and now. To me, Pacific Rim is the closest thing we have now to a modern Star Wars. Just this beautiful mix of all these different genres and film ideas and myths into like one singular story that just resonates with me and a lot of other people beautifully. And I adore it.
Wow, that's a hot take.
Yeah, but I stand by it.
I can respect it. All right.
Well, it's pretty easy now that the bar for Star Wars has been set so low, but, you know. Solo! Ha ha! Oh.
Yeah, it was a lot more. Yeah, that was a lot more impressive before the sequel trilogy came out.
I think what's funny is that I think all three of us agree. I think we all feel that way, Andrew, but I think it's for all different reasons. But
it's very true.
It is.
But So, as for me, I absolutely love this movie. I mean, I can definitely say it got overshadowed by Godzilla returning the next year, but it's still never quite left my brain. I've always had a deep love for this movie. You know, I don't want to get into any details until we get into the real discussion here, but it's just my whole jam. It's just a great time, and I can't wait to get into it. So, that'll bring us to our human characters.
I'll go with you. That's what the Jaeger pilots do. Share the neural load.
You're serious? You would do that for me? Or you would do that with me?
Well, with worldwide destruction a certain alternative, do I really have a choice?
Then say it with me, my man! We're gonna own this bad boy!
By Jove, we are going to own this thing for sure!
For our cast, we have Charlie Hunnam as Rally Beckett, Idris Elba as Marshall Stacker Pentecost, Rinko Kikuchi as Mako Mori, Charlie Day as Dr. Newton Newt Geisler, Bern Gorman as Dr. Herman Gottlieb, Ron Perlman as Hannibal Chow, Robert Kaczynski as Chuck Hansen, Max Martini as Hercules Herc Hansen, Clifton Collins Jr. as Tendo Choi, Diego Klattenhoff as Yancey Beckett, Mana Ashida as Young Mako, Robert Malet as Lieutenant Sasha Kaidanovsky, Heather Dirkinson as Lieutenant Alexis Kaidanovsky, and Charles Liu, Lance Liu, and Mark Liu as the Wei Tang triplets.
I wonder if they were the kind of triplets that, like, you cast them because they're triplets, because they have similar faces, but they couldn't act, because I don't think they get, like, a single line in the movie. And I did read that about a half hour was cut out of this of, like, largely character stuff, that a lot of arcs were trimmed to the bare minimum.
Oh, wow.
So I wonder if all their material was just on the cutting room floor, or if that was one of those, look, we're casting for triplets. You'll take what we can get. They're not going to be professional actors. Just have them play basketball, and then we'll kill them off.
Yeah, I always just assumed that they just kind of didn't have a big role for them. But now that you mentioned that, I'm kind of wondering if they had more for them.
I genuinely did not know that, and that makes me very interested, because I already think this movie has some baller arcs, so I really want to see what the full first would be like. But yeah, that's pretty much fair. I think that's about how their acting stands. So I do remember, I think they get one line in Crimson Typhoon before Otachi ends them instantly. But yeah, they're just kind of like, we're here too. Yay.
So before we jump into characters, which to me is the primary interest for this movie, but since we also will talk about some plot details and things here, just a starting observation. The opening bridge flashback is really weird in retrospect, how much it looks like the bridge scene in Godzilla 2014. And then Gypsy Danger is later thrown through the bridge in Hong Kong that Godzilla destroys in Godzilla vs. Kong. And they have a big fight in downtown Hong Kong. Was the MonsterVerse like intentionally homaging Pacific Rim the whole time and we never noticed? Because it's kind of weird that there are four films from Legendary, and two of those four films both have major set pieces in the same place that the first film had major set pieces in. Like, of the four films, there were only like three major cities: San Francisco, Boston, and Hong Kong. And that just struck me as really weird, seeing this after the MonsterVerse, being like, was that intentional? Was Legendary referencing itself?
It's like poetry, it rhymes. But yes, I do think it's an homage, especially because at the moment, unless whatever's going on with Adam Wingard and Legendary ever result in something, it is the last big American kaiju movie. I do think Godzilla vs. Kong was doing that intentionally. But yeah, it's really, really kind of crazy. It's kind of like, it's like rewatching GMK and noticing all the repeat shots they do from 1954. It's like, is this intentional or is it just like a happy coincidence? But I would also like to say, while I'm taking up time, that I genuinely love that basically the first 5 minutes of this movie with Trespasser is usually what an entire kaiju movie consists of. And in this film, it's literally just the, like, backstory.
Yeah, it's like they just sum up the whole, like, first movie of a franchise in the beginning of the actual first movie. But I don't think the Golden Gate Bridge thing was intentional, because at this point, by the time this movie had come out, like, Godzilla would have been filming, I believe. Either that or it would have been in post-production by now. So I feel like at that point it would have been too late to throw in a reference, but I could be wrong. You know, I don't know what was going through their heads at that point. But and you know, I also don't have a total grasp on what really goes into making a movie, so who knows, they could have just thrown that in there, but I don't think that would be the case.
They're just weirdly visually similar, it's the only thing. But yeah, I do love, like you guys were talking about, that opening montage, and I feel like the amount of world building and history crammed into it is really interesting. The idea of, you know, oh, we got good at this, and so then this happened to celebrities, this happened to the culture, we started thinking about kaiju this way, then things changed. Like, there's a whole lot of really dynamic ideas crammed in the first 5 minutes of this movie.
Yeah, like, I'd almost like to see a prequel to this, like, really going in depth on the backstory, but at the same time, I don't feel like I'd need it. Like, I'd accept it if they'd give it to me, and if it was directed by anybody other than Stephen S. DeKnight. But yeah, it's a really great opening. It kind of reminds me of the opening of, well, I should say the opening of Planet of the Monsters reminds me of the opening of this movie, but I think this movie is kind of better at it. It's at least kind of more entertaining, while the Planet of the Monsters opening montage isn't bad. You know, I'm not going to say I enjoy it because it's really quite heavy. But yeah, I just noticed kind of a similarity whenever I was watching this again.
You know, I actually do see it. There is definitely a lot of similarities between Planet Monsters and Pacific Rim, especially how they deliver the lines now that I think about it. But yeah, I really love the whole opening sequence. Just like, again, like I was saying earlier, just how quickly it runs through what would typically be an entire kaiju trilogy into like one backstory. And I especially love the bit about them getting desensitized to the kaiju and seeing like, oh, we're going to merchandise them and oh, they're so silly before knife head attacks. Because one thing I think that's a genius idea and what would probably happen is it's the real thing. But I also genuinely think it might be a commentary on the kaiju genre as a whole. Because, you know, we start off with like the genuine horror movies like Gojira and Rodan and everything. And then it ended up becoming like kid stuff. More or less, as much as I friggin' love stuff like Godzilla vs. Megalon. So I wonder if that was Del Toro, like, nodding at the history of the genre.
It could also be him nodding to, like, the later Showa era films where you would see kids, like, playing with Godzilla toys and everything.
Oh, yeah, that too.
But just to get into my only real, like, big criticism with the movie, and it's not even that big now that I've thought about it a bit more since rewatching the movie. But I don't really like Charlie Hunnam. Like, from the opening narration, I'm just kind of like, I can't really stand the way this guy delivers his lines. Like, he always kind of sounds like he's doing, like, a cool guy voice, and it just drives me nuts. But after reading Del Toro's reason for picking Charlie Hunnam, I kind of started to look at his casting a little bit differently. I still don't like him, but just this quote that says, I saw him and I thought he had an earnest, really honest nature. And he was the kind of guy that I can relate to as a male audience member. I go, I like that guy. I would like to have a few beers with that guy. He has an earthy quality. And I can, you know, when I read that and I was kind of thinking back to certain scenes in that movie, I could kind of get what he was talking about. Again, I still don't really like his delivery of certain lines or most of his lines, but I could definitely see where he would see that quality in him. He definitely does feel like, just like when I'm watching the movie, just his face alone, he just kind of looks like a down-to-earth person, specifically in a scene where he's talking to Mako in private after their first drift attempt, which I will get into a bit later.
Yeah, I can't say that he is by any means the most standout of the cast. He's probably the one that I would have to say the least about, but I did feel like he was solid. He served an anchoring protagonist role well. He was unobtrusive. I mean, you know, it's another Ford Brody. It's like, he's there. He does the job he's supposed to be. He lets you see through his eyes. He may not be that exciting, but he gets the job done.
I will say I do really like his acting in the scene where he's running after Pentecost. After he confronts him about grounding the two of them from piloting again, I do really like him in that scene.
I'm in a split place with Raleigh. I think he's got a good, like, written arc, but I do agree that that as good as Charlie Hunnam acting is and being, like, very earnest, like you said, Nick, he just never really gripped me as much as the other characters. He's still very good, though, and I really, really like him. And it sure would be a shame if, you know, they made a sequel where they don't even mention what happened to him and have him never show up on screen. But what are the odds of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that they never even made a sequel to this movie, you know? I mean, such potential. So I think we should move into one of the other leads in this movie, which is Mako Mori, as I said, played by Rinko Kikuchi, who is a character that I really, really like, but I feel like I don't have a lot to say about. I think she has a very good, compelling arc, and I kind of like that she's very quiet. I kind of find that relatable because, you know, aside from the fact that I do a podcast where I have to talk for a long time, I'm a very quiet person typically, so I kind of like having one of the leads in one of my favorite movies in my favorite genre kind of be very quiet like that. I don't know, for some reason on this past rewatch, that was just kind of the thing I noticed most about that character.
I'm in much the same position with a lot of this movie, actually, that I enjoy and appreciate aspects, but find that I don't have a lot to say about them. They speak for themselves, and I don't have much to add. For me, Mako's story and the concept of a vengeance too strong to share with another pilot makes for the most involving viewing. Like, of all the storylines, hers was the one that held me the most, and I feel like she was the character that I was the most emotionally invested in by the end.
I am f***ing love Mako. She's, without a doubt, my favorite protagonist in any kaiju movie of the past decade. I genuinely love how she's, like, vengeance-seeking, but not overly aggressive. She's traumatized, but strong. I don't even have words. Like, I just genuinely love her so much. I think she's played perfectly. I think her arc is, like, the best part of the movie. She's just... I can't really think of anything else to say. I think she's just great. And, like, how many times did the kaiju character end up having a whole film criticism test named after her?
I was unaware of that.
Yeah, there was a big upcry after the movie came out because this movie failed the Bechdel test, but it's a very strong story with her as the lead, more or less. I'm going to say it. Mako's the lead of this movie. Rowley's just kind of like the protagonist that introduces us to the real protagonist, like Big Trouble in Little China. But yeah, there's a lot of people who are upset about that, and so it created the idea of the Mako Mori test, which is like, the Mako Mori test is a test which analyzes films along the following lines. It has one female character who gets her own narrative arc that is not about another man's story.
Nice.
Past Mako, I felt like, her story was the one that involved me the most. My favorite characters were probably the duo of doctors, Gottlieb and Geisler. They're just a lot of fun to me, and they just bounce wonderfully off of each other. I especially love their, like, psyching each other up to drift with the kaiju brain, and, like, their awkward failed handshake slash fist bump slash whatever you want to call it. Like, it's funny that I like Gottlieb better as a character, although he has much less screen time, but they're honestly both at their best when they're both together.
Yeah, those two are my favorite characters in the movie. I just find them so much fun. I love how, like, they're cartoony, but in, like, the best way, and it just perfectly fits the movie, in my opinion. And I do prefer Newt, personally. I mean, I think they're both wonderful, so it doesn't really matter. But Charlie Day just has such an endearing screen presence, in my opinion. He is just always so much fun to watch. And I just feel like he has such great chemistry with everyone in this movie. Like, just especially aside from Bern Gorman, he has really great chemistry with Ron Perlman. And whenever they're on screen together, I'm just having a total blast. And I just, if I were to become an actor and I could pick one other actor to star in a movie alongside, it would be him. Because I feel like he just gives me the vibe that he brings such energy to his roles that it just would automatically translate to the whatever actor he's working with. I don't know if that's even true, but that's just the vibe I get from him, because he just looks like he's constantly having a great time.
I was distracted in this movie. Was it just me? I felt like I was watching J.J. Abrams acting in a movie. Like, I feel like those guys could play brothers.
He does look like J.J. Abrams in this movie.
They're, like, identical. Oh my god, now I need a comedy where Charlie Day plays J.J. Abrams being chased by, like, angry Star Wars and Star Trek fans now. But I agree. This movie is my introduction to Charlie Day. I've loved him ever since. He is a fantastic actor. Newt is genuinely the greatest. I do love Herman a lot. I love the numbers are the closest thing we have to the writing of God, and just, like, Newt laughing in the background. I genuinely think they have such great chemistry, and I do love them. Just this whole idea of, like, an old-school stuffy scientist and a punk rock cool scientist teaming up to solve the issue, which is another thing I know it's a rewatch. I really like. I love that it's not like, oh, one of them's right, one of them's wrong. Nope, both of them are right, and they have to combine their information about the breach and their information about the kaiju DNA to figure out the solution to nuke the breach. I think that's really, really cool, and I genuinely think they are a blast to watch the whole time, especially when they in the Hannibal Chow scenes. Charlie Day just nails, like, both incredibly excited and incredibly nervous.
And isn't it funny to continue our MonsterVerse discussion that once again, thematically, American giant monster movies are still on the theme of, nuke is the solution. Like, they're like two kinds of sci-fi movies. Like, in both of them, everyone wants to use nukes to solve the problem. And one of them is like, no, you fool, that will only make it worse. That will destroy the planet. What are you doing? Even some American films like Independence Day go that way. And the other half is like, no, we just have to figure out where to put the nuke in the right place. That's going to solve everything, guys. It's like the sort of the Star Trek approach versus the Stargate approach. You know, we must find a peaceful solution. We can't just be warmongering. The other is, look, we just got to find the right place to blow it up. And then we're good. Even Independence Day, they have their cake and eat it too. They're like, you fools, we can't use nukes on Earth. We'll destroy the planet. And it didn't even work. What have we done? Oh, but if we put the nuke in space where their spaceships are, yeah, we're good. We saved the day.
Yeah, kind of bugs me a little bit about this movie. Not as much as King of the Monsters, because I feel like with Godzilla, like, there's kind of a lot less room to do that. But with an original property, it's not as bad. But it's still not a thing I'm a big fan of. But I can get past it much, much more easily with this movie.
Speaking of Independence Day, I do think it's an interesting concept with the alien colonists who just kind of use up worlds and move on. It does really feel like it echoes that movie. They use the same basic premise. But the concept of, you know, growing successive waves of kaiju as an army, constantly testing and upgrading, kind of like, you know, Syndrome in The Incredibles, is a really interesting, if the aliens idea feels generally been there, done that, the kaiju escalating army definitely feels like a nice new contribution to the genre.
I agree. The aliens just feel like kind of like a, basically just a retread of the idea of like Independence Day and the classic 70s stuff. I really do love the kaiju army idea, especially that it's, I also feel like it might be a nod to all the times when someone had to reuse an old kaiju suit for a new monster. Like, put a frill on Godzilla. Look, kids, Ultraman's gonna fight G-Ras. So I think it's just a very good idea. And also I wanted to add that the nuke stuff is iffy, but like you were saying, Nick, because it's not like Godzilla, which has had a very anti-nuclear core to its themes, doesn't really bother me. Though I do think if they ever do a Godzilla crossover, that should be the reason that the breach sent out too much radiation. He's like, what the heck is this? That'd be a fun little like, uh-oh.
Wow, that's not a bad idea.
But man, Guillermo del Toro showing Zone Fighter, this is what a kaiju army looks like. Not just like, oh, it's only two guys by the time we actually get to it. Well, it is only two guys by the time they get to it, but they do it like two or three times, so it still feels impressive.
Yeah. So to go back to Herman and Newt, Brendan, you said that you pointed out how one is like an old school, like mathematical scientist, and the other is like a punk rock dude who's like chill and laid back and is obsessed with giant monsters. That just, you know, kind of got me thinking that every pair in this movie, no two of them are all that similar. You know, like there's those two, like you said, and then there's Mako and Rally, who, you know, like I said, Mako is very quiet and reserved, and then Rally is much more aggressive and talkative. Not quite talkative, but whenever they're in the Jaeger, he's just constantly yelling stuff. But
yeah, that's been one of my few problems. Just like, how many times during the movie he's just yelling stupid shit in the Jaeger, like,
yeah,
let's get this sucker and all that stuff. It's just like, dude, we get it, you're in a robot, stop acting like you have to overact to emphasize you're in a robot. I can see the set you guys built. I can tell you're in the Jaeger. Relax, Charlie.
And then Newt gets paired up with, I can't remember any of his names.
Hannibal
Newt
Chow?
Yes, thank you. Then Newt gets paired up with Hannibal Chow, and who is much more gruff and hardened and doesn't take any shit. And then you have the Australian father-son duo, where one is a nice guy and the other one's just a total ass. And then the son of that, and that duo gets paired later on with Stacker Pentecost, who, you know, is just a stone cold badass, where the Australian kid is like insecure and is very just rude all the time. I don't know. I just, what you said just got me thinking about how different all the characters are from each other. No two have the same personality. And I just really, really appreciate that. And one more thing is I like how Newt and Herman are like seen bickering like off to the side of the screen before they're even introduced. And I don't know. I just kind of like that. They kind of prepare you for what these two characters are like before you properly meet them.
Speaking of the Australian father-son duo, I did think it was an interesting dynamic there with a friendly face as Raleigh's confidant and friend, and then his son as an antagonist with father and son not seeing eye to eye. It's almost like a love triangle, but with antagonism. And I thought, you know, the father's angst at having to send his son into battle without him at the end was pretty powerful. Not enough to get any of us to learn their names, clearly, but it was, you know, they worked really well throughout the plot. And I enjoyed the things that they did with them.
I know their names, but whenever I'm talking, when I'm trying to like, sometimes when I go on a tangent, my mouth moves faster than my brain does. But I know their names are Chuck and Herc, but I'm having a hard time for some reason quickly remembering the character names in this movie, despite the characters in this being the strongest thing about the movie, in my opinion, and also the fact that there are some of my favorite characters in the genre.
I agree totally on both counts. Well, in general, I think that they're well acted and that they do, but they mainly just play the role to expect. Chuck and Herc's goodbye is genuinely one of my favorite parts of the movie. Just like how they're trying to make an entire lifetime of thing they've never said, like say them in front of each other. And it's really, it gets me misty-eyed every time, especially when he says goodbye to Max. Just because I'm a big old softy.
Breaks my heart every time.
It's my son you got there. My son.
But I was just going to say that, yeah, I do think like the whole like opposite thing, because it definitely helps strengthen the message about cooperation and like, of course, this movie's about relationships, getting along with someone you disagree with, accepting you can't protect your child forever, moving past trauma with one another. It's really beautiful, and I like how it's like, even if you disagree, even if you're different, you have to accept each other and work together because it's for the good of everyone, especially with these circumstances. I think that's probably my favorite thing about the movie.
And, you know, Nick, reflecting off what you said about the characters being the strongest part of the story, I agree. I enjoy Stacker Pentecost as a character, you know, because Idris Elba is great. And I enjoyed his speech, but the thought struck me while I was watching that part, you know, the canceling the apocalypse speech, that as fun as all the kaiju action is, I feel almost more engaged by the character story of the first half of the movie than I do all the monster action in the second half, which is ironic, like I was saying, because according to Wikipedia, a bunch of almost a half hour of material involving character arcs and their stories was removed from this film, with each being cut down to their bare required minimum, according to the filmmakers, which makes me wonder, well, what else was there? Because if that already felt like the strongest part to me, you know, how good was it before it was cut? Or is it being cut down what made it so good? But I felt like even the ending shot was a really good shot of just of Mako and Raleigh, you know, sort of kneeling on the, you know, escape pod in the middle of the Pacific with helicopters coming over. And I felt like it really emphasized there were no Jaegers around. We had some military hardware, but they were just coming to check on them. You know, it emphasized to me that this film was at its heart about relationships far more than it was about giant monsters. And I just really appreciate about this film that I feel like it is a character piece that is about loss and about trauma and about healing and about trust that just happens to use giant monsters, you know, to keep the interest up and to keep the plot moving. But that's not what it's really about. It's about relationships between people.
Yeah, that's actually the thing that the big realization I had watching this movie this time too. Like, you know, I've seen this movie loads of times and I've always enjoyed it just as much, but this time it just really hit me that ultimately what this movie is truly about at its core is trust and unity and love and friendship and fatherhood and all that. And like what Brendan was saying, like about how, you know, you have to work together, even if you disagree and everything, and no matter how different you are, ultimately working together is what's going to get things done. And it just kind of feels like Guillermo del Toro, it just kind of felt like he really learned from the messages of Ishiro Honda movies. And I mean, maybe that's just something he felt strongly about regardless, but that's just kind of what comes to my mind, is it feels like a very, it feels like a very Honda type of story, in my opinion, or at least message.
I agree fully. I even put down my note, this movie is basically Honda's quote about the brotherhood of man rewritten for the modern age, and that's why I love it. It's just, and the fact that, like you guys were saying, like you took the words right out of my mouth about how it uses this story to tell a story about trauma and pain and everything, and about how we can move through it together to face impossible odds. It's just amazing. I don't even have words. It's been like, what, 8 years now? And it still absolutely blows me away every time I watch it, how good it does it.
Just a final note for me on characters. I am glad that Hannibal Chow survived, if only out of affection for Ron Perlman. Like, I'm not really sure the character is a good guy, as it were, but I really enjoy him nonetheless. So I'm glad that they just stuck that in there, that his... It felt like they gave him a Kong Skull Island. Oh, come on! There's no need for that kind of a death. But then it's like, oh, no, it's okay. He's fine. He wants to know where his shoe is. It's all right.
Yeah, he's definitely not a good guy, but he's just such a fun character to watch. And a lot of that is down to Ron Perlman and also, like, the character design, sort of. Like, he has such a cool look to him. Like, all his designer clothes and his gold-plated shoes and those cool glasses and the scar over his eye, which just makes me think of my favorite line from Newt Geisler, which is,
"Guess who's back, you one-eyed bitch!"
And yeah, I don't like the circumstances of his fake-out death, which I'll get to when we talk about the monsters and everything. But yeah, I'm glad that he survived, and I like the sort of mid-credits scene.
Where is my goddamn shoe?
He's just a wonderful character. And like I said earlier, his chemistry with Charlie Day is just wonderful.
Yeah, I like Hannibal Chow a lot. I think he's a great, like, mini antagonist, and I agree with everything Nick said, especially about how great he is as a character, combining his wonderful design and Ron Perlman being, like, the best actor ever.
Just one final thought on the plot. I already mentioned the similarity future MonsterVerse movies had to this, and how this had some similarity to Independence Day. And we said, well, we don't think that Godzilla 2014 could copy this necessarily because of how closely they were in production. I also don't think a year's time is enough to consciously copy the Avengers, so it's presumably a very large coincidence. But the end of this film is the end of the Avengers. Like, the pilot of a high-tech humanoid weapons-laden machine rides a nuke through a breach, blowing up the aliens on the other side and escaping back just in the nick of time, but seeming to be dead because he's not breathing, only to be revived at the last moment. Like, it seems really bizarre to have that specific, a direct copy of the ending of two completely separate movies by chance, although that is seemingly what happened. Like... it just happened. It's weird.
Yeah, that is. I never thought of it, but once you pointed that out, that's definitely pretty weird how similar they are. So my final thought, well, first of all, I just want to say that even though I don't have a whole lot to say about him, I really like Pentecost. I think he's a great character. Idris Elba is just super cool, like coolest man alive. And I just like his whole thing with being the only person, aside from being the one of only two people, including Rally, to ever pilot a Jaeger solo. And just him finally getting back into one is awesome. And I like his whole relationship with Mako and everything. I like how Stacker bows before he enters Mako's room. She was orphaned at such a young age, and he raised her after her parents died. And it feels like he really could have very, very easily just sort of converted her to American culture, but instead he chooses to respect hers, which is really nice. And it's not something I really picked up on until I watched it this time, but it's just a little thing that I noticed about the character that I really like.
Idris Elba, the coolest motherfucker on this planet. And someday I hope to have the sheer amount of, like, not even, like, coolness, just, like, downright awe that I feel with Marshall Pentecost. I genuinely love his character, and I especially love his whole relationship with Mako. I really love how at the end, when Mako says her last goodbyes to him, it's unsubtitled because I believe Del Toro said it's between them. It's not something that we're supposed to know. And I think it's just a genuinely beautiful relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, it's very nice. And I just really, just talking about how cool Idris Elba is, I just really love the part where Raleigh grabs his arm in anger and then he turns around and he just looks at him and he says,
"One, don't you ever touch me again. Two, don't you ever touch me again."
So good. But so yeah, my final thought for the human characters is the scene where Raleigh's talking to Mako after their first failed attempt at drifting. And, you know, he's talking about loss and everything and losing his brother and how, like, once someone lives in your head for so long after they die, the hardest thing to deal with is the silence. And whenever he's saying all that, the lighting in the scene is very blue and, like, cool-toned and kind of slightly dark. And then once he starts talking about how you have to trust someone to drift with them, and he tells Mako that their drift was strong, the lighting then turns brighter and is much warmer in tone. And I just think that's really, really nice. It's just a really nice bit of visual storytelling. Let's move on to monsters, mechs, and special effects.
Come on! Let's do this together!
Before we go any further, of course, the primary Jaeger in this film is named Gypsy Danger, and we are aware, especially over in Europe, but globally, that the term Gypsy has racial slur connotations. It is not our intent or desire to offend. In the case of this movie, the main Jaeger is actually named for the Gypsy Miner engine, which was used in a number of World War II aircraft because of the World War II aesthetic that Guillermo del Toro was bringing to the film. It is not intended to reference any people group or to cause offense in any way, but of course, the two names are audibly identical when you're doing radio. So we just wanted to point out that we are aware of that. We do apologize if the name is problematic to any of our listeners, but we also felt that we couldn't really discuss the film without mentioning the actual name of the main mech. And if we tried to change it to something else, that would just be more distracting and pull attention to the problem word anyway. So again, we do use the name of this mech, aware of the baggage that its syllables entail, but without any intent to offend, just to cite the name used in the original movie.
And if you think there's a better way we can go about this, just feel free to let us know, because as Andrew was saying, the last thing we want is to upset anyone over this. So yeah, just if you think there's a better way for us to handle this, there's contact information in the description and at the end of every single episode. If you want to hit us up and tell us a way that you think is better for us to go about this, because yeah, we don't want to upset or offend anyone listening to this. So let us know how we're doing on that. We would appreciate that. So with that out of the way, the special effects in this film were done by Industrial Light and Magic of Star Wars fame, Legacy Effects, and Hybrid Technologies.
The kaiju category thing, I think, is a really good way for the audience to keep track of how dangerous they are. I feel like there's probably a sizable segment of Godzilla fandom that wishes that we had the same thing and basically has their own mental version of that ranking system already. So just seeing it formalized was a nice shorthand for a movie that we haven't had a bunch of movies with these kaiju to level set them, to, you know, get an idea of how dangerous they are. So it was a good shorthand. I thought that was a good system. Not exactly the Godzilla prediction or the Godzilla alert system from Versus Biollante or anything, but still a good system to frame the movie.
Also, I like that it's called the Sarazawa scale. That's nice.
Oh, is it? I missed that.
Yeah, it is.
On another side note, I forgot that GLaDOS from Portal was in here.
Pylons ready to connect.
Like, that's just weird. It's as if the MonsterVerse had, like, Strong Bad as one of their computer voices. I just find it kind of distracting. Like, yes, she had a great computer voice, which is why GLaDOS is iconic. But GLaDOS is iconic. You can't just straight up use it in your movie because you like it. Like, if you turn on Mechagodzilla and say, activate voice interface, and the voice is like, it's-a me, Mechagodzilla, people are going to be taken out of the movie. It's just a weird choice.
Okay, but they should do it anyway, because that would be brilliant.
I'm going to destroy Tokyo now. Woohoo!
Instant classic.
Instant.
I did feel like at least all of the tech in the cockpits, like the leg walking mechanisms and everything, is really cool. And it even works out to become an obstacle to Raleigh in the final sequence, an actual threat to him. So I thought that was all very nicely done.
Yeah, the practical effects for the cockpit is amazing. I especially love it because of the behind-the-scenes fact that Rinko Kikuchi was the only one on set who didn't have any problems or get hurt in them. But in general, they're just amazing practical effects for a very CGI-heavy movie.
Because she's a badass.
You're right.
She's the biggest badass of our time.
You're right.
The other, I assume, at least partially great practical effect. I mean, I assume it had to have been enhanced with CGI. But the end of the opening sequence where Raleigh staggers out onto the beach and Gypsy Danger is just lying out there, I thought was really impressive, that he's just walking by this giant prone mech.
You mean after losing a Pacific limb?
Yes. Yes, at that point.
I love that shot so much. It's genuinely just such a great use of scale after we've mainly been seeing the kaiju and Jaeger fight from, like, without any, like, reference points except for the boat.
The one other thing this opening sequence I thought especially just pointed out to me on the general, without talking about any of the specific Jaegers or kaiju yet, is just that the sound design in this is definitely made for the theater, or, you know, some really high-end sound systems. Like, even in this opening fight, I could tell that I was missing something with just my ordinary TV speakers.
That noise permeates throughout the whole film, and it's not the same on a TV.
So it's basically a modern movie trailer stretched out to 2 hours length.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is amazing sound design. I love how it literally feels like you can almost, like, feel like how it the roars and the horns would echo when you see the thing in real life.
I have to wonder, though, is that the actual sound the Jaegers are making, or is that just, like, non-diegetic?
I think I did read somewhere it is supposed to be diegetic. It's like an alarm they have that they play to be like, the Jaeger's here, please evacuate, we're gonna deal with the kaiju. And or, like, if they're doing the whole stunt with the boat to, like, let the people in danger know. But I might be wrong on that. I don't remember where I heard that. I think I read it back in, like, 2014, so maybe it's wrong. I don't know.
We just thought that, you know, like, a dog whistle drives dogs crazy. Maybe a foghorn would really drive those kaiju nuts. We stuck one on every Jaeger, sometimes three.
I think this movie's got really nice looking CGI. I mean, I think a lot of the modern American, well, I mean, really, just even Shin Godzilla. So just the most, really, the modern giant monster movies that have been coming out since this movie came out have got really good CGI. The only one I can think of that's not quite as good is Rampage, but that one had a significantly lower budget. I mean, not compared to Shin Godzilla, but it showed the monsters more than Shin Godzilla did. But yeah, I just feel like we're in an age of really good CGI in monster movies. And it's kind of nice that now that suit acting is kind of not really a thing in, like, in monster movies. You know, it's still in like the tokusatsu TV shows and everything, but like, it's kind of, you know, it's purely coincidence, I think, but like, it's kind of weird that it just so happened that the Suitmation era ended, and then we got a really long break from kaiju movies, and then now that they're back, it's in the era of just CGI being just absolutely bonkers. So I don't know. I kind of like that it just happened to play out that way. And it just kind of makes being away from suit acting just a little easier.
For some, maybe.
I think my favorite kaiju in this movie has to be Otachi, which I know is the popular answer, but it's the popular answer for a reason, all right? Just look at her. She's wonderful. Like, she's the most visually striking, in my opinion. I mean, she kind of has the generic, like, modern monster, like, huge arms, like, sprawled out. But she's still really cool. She's got that cool-ass tail that grabs things, the really weird, like, flower, like, bioluminescent tongue, and just the acid spray and everything, which feels very Biollante. And, you know, the wing reveal is awesome when she just spreads her arms and then the friggin' wings just aggressively just shoot out from her arms. It's awesome.
And they did say in the Wikipedia that they designed her to be kind of a Swiss Army knife, specifically because they knew she was going to have the most screen time, so they wanted to keep things interesting by, you know, being able to do new reveals, which I think was a good choice.
Yeah, I did hear about that too. I have a lot of stuff to say about Otachi, because again, she's my favorite kaiju in the movie. Maybe even one of my favorite original kaijus of the Renaissance. I don't know, maybe. But yeah, I genuinely love her. I love that, on top of being just a well-designed monster, there's also the subtle storytelling of watching her. You can tell what her role is, like what the precursors made her for. Like, okay, she had the wings to get over the walls, and then can attack the city with the, or she had the acid to melt it with, and then she's pregnant, so if she dies, the baby can take over. I think that's great storytelling, and in general, I do love, because I'm going to have to quote a source, which is Matt from the Monsters Conquer the World blog and podcast, because he's the one who tipped me off to it, and then I found it out again here, which is that there's a very good bit in the commentary where Guillermo del Toro also explains that on top of the whole Swiss Army knife thing, part of the reason Otachi changes so much is his philosophy that if you're making a monster movie, you're torn between not showing a monster a lot so the audience doesn't get desensitized to it, or making a monster that changes a lot so that it's very unique and they never know what's going to happen next. And I think Otachi is a beautiful example of that.
Yeah, she's just fantastic. And that Hong Kong fight in general is just awesome. Like, every second of it is so entertaining to me. And another criticism I have of this movie is that I find it way more entertaining than the final battle. But yeah, just whenever it's Cherno Alpha and Crimson Typhoon versus Leatherback and Otachi, all the way up until Danger just slamming into the ground at the end from that fall, it's just pure kaiju versus mech excellence. I love it so much. It's just, my heart's beating so fast the whole time. It's just so good. I'm at a loss for words, really. I can't really put my enjoyment of it into words. It's hard to describe. It's just, you know, and then the last two battles in Godzilla versus Kong are so awesome. It just feels like if you have monsters and robots fighting in Hong Kong, it's almost like you're just guaranteed to have an awesome fight.
So I'm going to go with the probably very unpopular opinion. I do enjoy the fight. Yes, but I don't find any of the kaiju in this movie particularly interesting or notable in design. Like, honestly, the same thing could be said of King of the Monsters too. Like, I think the Mutos and the Warbat are like the only kaiju from the 2010s that I think are really as interesting or unique as Toho kaiju typically have been. I just find something generic and generally uninspired about the overall package in a lot of the modern monsterverse, you know, the legendary kaiju and the Jaegers, for that matter. I don't really distinguish between them that much. I enjoy the action that they do and the characters that are in them, the things that they are doing in the plot, a lot more than I really do their design. So for me, each of these probably has one or two really notable design features, and that's it. I would say, yeah, for Otachi, the bioluminescent tongue, and I do think probably Otachi has the most unique and interesting design of the kaiju and the prehensile tail. So, well, I find this a generally samey bunch. I don't have trouble distinguishing between them like I did in the theater, but I still don't really find them different enough to be interesting. And they do have a good story reason, a common origin to be more samey. But yeah, so it's kind of a valedictorian of summer school kind of situation. But I did find Otachi definitely the most interesting of them. I just probably, unlike most fans of this movie, just don't find the design of any of the giant entities very interesting.
I mean, yeah, in terms of the kaiju, the only ones that I really, that like really stick out in my mind are Leatherback and Otachi, possibly because they have the best action set piece in the whole movie, in my opinion. And also because they're the ones that kind of look the most unique. Like, Leatherback is just a weird reptilian gorilla. And, you know, Otachi is just that Swiss Army knife that we talked about. And they're also they're the only two, as far as I know, as far as I can remember, they're the only two with, like, a power. Like, Leatherback has the EMP, and then Otachi has the acid spray that I mentioned. So I feel like that adds to why they're the only two that really stick out in my mind. But yeah, I think the kaiju, as much as I prefer monsters over robots in general, just in my life, I don't prefer the kaiju in this movie to the Jaegers.
Yeah, they're the few kaiju I do like. Like, Leatherback, like you said, I really dig his beefiness. And I can't help but wonder if he's supposed to be a Toho Kong reference, given all the gorilla running and the fact that he has an electric power. And I do like the final kaiju just because I think that, well, no, I like Slattern, the big boss. Watching this again, I do like Knifehead a lot. I really like how he's very bulky, but he's got like a little, he's got a devious streak to him. I do like the kaiju in this movie. I do think they can be better, even though I do like what Del Toro does with them.
I agree that I do like Slattern. And he definitely feels nicely imposing. He does have a good look. I found Raiju and Scunner a bit hard to distinguish between, although I do really like, I said each of them has like one feature except for Scunner for me in this movie. Like, Scunner just has nothing that I latch onto, but Raiju, I really like the face within a face. And I agree on Knifehead. I really like that he has like a goblin shark style face and the yellow vein patterning on him. That's those are the features that really stand out for him to me. Similarly, the blue veining on Leatherback is his feature that I like, although his body shape to me is the least notable. Well, no, Scunner's is the least notable, but Leatherback's the second. Anyway, those are the parts that I liked on each of them.
For me, the kaiju, the three kaiju at the end, all very, very much blend together. Except for, yeah, Raiju's face in a face. That is extremely cool. But Scunner and Slattern, first of all, I never remember what Scunner even looks like. Anytime someone mentions him, I have to Google him.
He looks like two pieces floating gradually apart.
Is he the one that gets cut in half?
No, that's Raiju.
Yeah, Raiju gets cut in half. Scunner's the one whose face they burn in the volcano thing. But yeah, I just don't care at all about Scunner. He's easily the weakest. Not like physically, but like, you know, in terms of remembering him, he's the least memorable. And I don't care about Slattern either. I like his tail things. Those are neat. But other than that, the only shot of him that I can remember is the one where they're about to go into the breach and then he just slowly rises up. Everything else, I just don't remember him at all. I'm just not a huge fan of that third act. I mean, once they're in the breach, I like it, but I don't like that fight, honestly. I just don't find it very engaging.
I actually do enjoy that fight to a degree. Certainly not as much as Hong Kong, but I feel like the emotions happening there and the trying to get to the breach, at least, it's more interesting in the latter half than the first half, but there's something there.
Yeah, definitely. The character stuff is good.
I also just wanted to mention the one other one that I can so easily overlook, but actually one of my favorite designs is the crab monster from Mako's flashback. I don't have any idea what its name is, but I really like the look of that one.
It's named Onibaba, and I agree. She is fantastic. But that's mainly because that whole scene is amazing to me. That scene has the highest acclaim I can give any movie scene, which is that you could take that whole scene and release it as a short film and it would work perfectly. It is so good. It is beautiful. It is tense. It is horrifying. It's endearing at the end. I love it so much. I could literally talk about it forever.
Yeah, it's a great scene. And you really feel for little Mako there. And yeah, Onibaba's awesome. Definitely my favorite. Not that this is a super high bar or that there's very much competition, but Onibaba is probably my favorite crustacean monster. But yeah, just that's an excellent scene.
Speaking of which, toward the end of that scene, there's a really nice transition where the camera sweeps sideways in sort of a medium shot of little Mako behind a rubble, and as it comes out from the other side, it is now like a wide shot from much farther away. I thought that was very nicely done.
So are we ready to talk about the Jaegers?
I think so.
Yeah, so while most of the kaiju kind of melt together in my brain in this movie, that is not the case for the Jaegers, for me personally. I enjoy them quite a bit. I think they all look pretty distinct, and my favorite is definitely Cherno Alpha. I just love the weird, like, head shape. That thing just looks like a tank, and it's awesome. And just its huge, like, blocky fists, just watching them punch things is just so satisfying. And its pilots are badass. They're just these really quiet, imposing Russians, and they're awesome. But Cherno Alpha is great, and Striker Eureka is awesome. I love how quick it is. When they fight Mutavor in Sydney, it's just watching that thing just hammer that kaiju in the face and then blast it with its like chest rockets is just awesome.
I agree. Cherno Alpha was my favorite. I just love that it doesn't really have any weapons. It's just a giant old robot that's gonna punch the shit out of any kaiju it finds. And I agree, I love the pilot. My favorite bit that always makes me laugh my ass off is when everyone else is running away from Mako powering up the plasma cannon and they're just staring at it like, huh. But yeah, I love all the Jaegers in this movie, but Cherno Alpha is my favorite. I love how smooth Crimson Typhoon is, and Gypsy Danger is just iconic, but they're all really good designs. I really love how Del Toro gave them a very retro aesthetic in contrast to something very sleek and spiky and stylized like a Bay Transformer or being on it's the legendary Mechagodzilla. And yeah, it's very neat.
Yeah, I'm sorry that I have to strike a similar note to before in that I don't see a whole lot of difference between these to me. Like, not that I can't tell them apart, but that I don't... There's a very little difference between them on the ranking level, but I think I have to agree. I do really like the unique face, the big head of Cherno Alpha, and I definitely really like the pilots. In fact, it almost seems cruel in the backstory. They're like 7 years undefeated and like one of the oldest ones in service, and then they just get so like unceremoniously, perfunctorily, completely killed off by this one kaiju sneak attack. You're like... It's like those, it's like in Star Trek, you know, where a ship named Enterprise can have like 20 years of uneventful service, but then a movie comes, it's going to get blown up, you know? It's like, there are so many things in a lot of franchises, honestly, where you're just like, according to the backstory, they've had decades of everything's fine, but because it's time for the movie, it is time for them to suddenly lose and die. It's just, it seems a shame. because they were really cool. Felt like they deserved better, their in-universe legacy. But I did think it was also interesting, notable, I just looked up on Wikipedia that Gypsy Danger's rounded look was apparently based on the style of Art Deco buildings, like the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building.
Yeah, I can see that, especially with the 1930s skyscraper building homage with the walls.
I like Crimson Typhoon a lot, too. Crimson Typhoon is sick with the three arms, and they got those blades spinning around on them. It's just awesome.
I will say that of the set, and it makes sense because obviously it's the focus one we get a chance to see the most of what it does, but I really like Gypsy Danger's array of weapons. It's got its own, you know, absolute zero cannon in its chest there. It's actually sort of more of a nuclear fire cannon, the opposite of absolute zero. It's got its plasma cannon, which really feels like that they need to start charging that before they go into bed. It's the Power Rangers thing. It's like, no, don't wait to finish the fight with that. Start with that. Have it already charged up when you arrive at the scene of battle. And then the sword is just awesome. There's something in science fiction about a really super high-tech mech techno, you know, super thing with all the bells and whistles. Just having a really advanced high-tech sword that is always awesome. I think there's just something in human psychology. It's like, nope. We may have plasma beams, we have Gatling guns, we have all this, but just go back to the sword. That will always be iconic. That will always be cool. It is definitely the Zone Fighter of the Jaegers. It's just got powers galore, and I really like that.
Zone Fighter would be a good Jaeger name.
It would. Also, this movie would be so much better if that was one of the Jaeger's powers, just like the machine gun bracelet, and they just mow a kaiju down.
And in the mid-sequence there with the whole Hong Kong battle, which I do feel like is definitely, as far as kaiju action, the centerpiece, the focal point of the film. First of all, I really love the idea of the kaiju actually hunting down Geisler from their drift connection. That's like really scary. And the whole re-entry sequence that climaxes the fight is intense. Like, it's quite a concept, and it really feels like an impossible problem. It's a, wait, how are they possibly going to survive this kind of thing? It's a really strong climax to that, a very nifty sequence of battles with mounting action and, you know, just the right amount of lulls and then back into the action sequence and then build and build and build in noise and fury and intensity until they touch down on the ground. It's very nicely executed.
Also, to go back to their weapons, the elbow rocket is dope. I wish I had an elbow rocket on my actual elbow. That would be sick.
My favorite is I really like that Striker Eureka has those big missiles in the chest, both because it feels very classic mecha, and I love that after they use it in a Mutavore fight, it never happens again. Because they can't fire it underwater for the finale, and they get taken out by the EMP before they can use it in Hong Kong. I feel like that's a very fun little subversion of expectations.
I will say, I forgot that Cherno Alpha is taken out in the first double kaiju event, I believe, and I guess it is fair to nerf a couple of these really skilled survivors to say, hey, when they double team the kaiju, that is upping things to a whole new level. So I guess it's not quite as ignominious as I initially gave it credit for.
Not to mention the kaiju are just getting stronger, too.
As for the end, I am not super impressed with the design of the aliens themselves. There's just something about it that feels a bit generic, even though I can't put my finger on it. It just kind of feels like a standard generic sci-fi design. Which is okay because they're really more of a MacGuffin than a central focus of the film. But it was unfortunate that there was nothing super spectacular about them. Although, and I didn't notice enough to say, perhaps they incorporated elements of the aliens' physiology into the kaiju. And that's actually why it felt generic or familiar, because we'd already been seeing it in the body shapes of the kaiju up to that point. In which case, that would actually be a nice touch instead of a poor one.
My favorite thing in this movie by far is the combat. Del Toro has a beautiful way of making every punch connect, and like you can feel the impact. I love how the constant rain lets you see like water ripple with every step. You see rain drops go flying with every punch. There's just something about this movie that makes the scale of the fighting look so good, and it's one of the main things that keeps me coming back to it. along with the amazing human story.
So for me, a little thing that kind of bothers me just a little bit, it's not like a huge problem, but I kind of felt like the baby Otachi coming out just to die felt a little cruel and unnecessary. Like, I get that it's just going to grow into a big murderous monster, but like, I just, you know, it still just kind of felt like watching a baby animal choke on its umbilical cord and die. And I'm just not really into that. Like, I get the reason for it being pregnant, you know, because Brendan kind of said what that was. But I don't know. It just kind of felt a little unnecessary for me. But we did get the mid-credits gag with Hannibal Chow out of it, so it's not all bad.
And as the Wikipedia points out, it's completely unaffected by Kaiju Blue, so maybe that's just Hannibal Chow is just that tough. You know, he can swim in it for a few hours and he's fine. What would kill lesser men?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree, Nick. It is kind of a bit uncomfortable. I honestly low-key wanted to see a sequel where it turns out it lives and it ends up becoming like an ally Kaiju solely because of the connection with Newt and Herman drifting with it.
After they stuck a giant nail into its brain.
Look.
That might undo some of the friendly feelings, you know?
Look, its mom somehow survived its mom going through reentry. It's a very strong baby.
It's true, yeah. When your parent gets cut in half, the fires of reentry followed by at terminal velocity hitting the ground, that is one hearty offspring, and actually just choking to death from half-formed lungs and the umbilical cord feels like a really rather an insult to someone that tough.
Yeah, but too bad there will never be a sequel to this movie.
So sad. At least we have the anime, but...
So let's move on to this film's score, which is composed by, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Ramin Djawadi. I'm not like super into this score, but there are two themes that really stick out to me. One is the sort of like kaiju theme. It's very nice and menacing, so I like it quite a bit. And the other is just the main theme of the film. I think it's genuinely very good, and it gets stuck in my head really easily, and it just kind of fits the sort of... I think it works well also as a theme for like the Jaegers and everything. And also it features Tom Morello playing the guitar, which is awesome because that's the guitarist from Rage Against the Machine, which is a band that I really enjoy.
Which is funny because they are actually raging against the kaiju with the machine.
That's true.
So how does the main theme go? I don't think I was able to pick that one out. Actually, my wife was talking about, she was in and out during this one. She was in the kitchen. And she was saying it was kind of unintentional comedy during the ending battle scene, because you kept getting like every 30 seconds the theme would come in and it would start dun 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 dun, and then it would get cut off because suddenly a bad reversal of the fight would happen. They were starting to win, but then the kaiju came and got, so it would just keep starting up and getting cut off, and then like 30 seconds later starting up again and getting cut off. And she said, just hearing it without being able to see the movie or any of the dialogue or anything, just the music itself, it sounded really funny. But I agree. I think it's also a really good main theme for the Jaegers. It really leans into the technical shock and awe kind of grand achievement machine vibe of it. It's a story of industry and guts and military might. It's a nice contrast to the kind of force of nature themes you get for Godzilla movies. This is an Iron Man kind of a theme. This is ingenuity and cool tech. You know, you can almost hear the gears turning. It's exactly what I would want the theme for a mecha-themed film to sound like.
It's actually funny you say that, because I'm going to butcher your name. I am very sorry. Ramin Jawadi actually scored the first Iron Man. So I love this score. I think it's super dope. I definitely love the electric, like, kind of like techno feel to it. I love that each of the kaiju, I mean, not the kaiju, the Jaegers have their own variation of the soundtrack. Like, Cherno had the Russian chanting. Striker Eureka had the more, like, metal version. Considering it's like the most sleekest and fastest. And then there's Gypsies, which has the classic. And I also just really love the kaiju score. It's got this really menacing quality with its deep brass that really makes it feel unique, but also very Ifukube inspired, like most kaiju soundtracks have to be lately, it seems.
So let's move on to Stray Thoughts.
Like I said earlier, I really feel like Pacific Rim is so much about human endeavor and about relationships. It's memories and trauma and the way the world changes. The psyche, the relationships, the soul. As much as even we have referenced and people have talked about a crossover with Godzilla, I feel like that would never work. Like, to tell the story properly takes too much focus, too much human identification. I feel like either Godzilla would end up even more superfluous than in Godzilla versus Kong, or else the Jaeger and their pilots would end up completely overshadowed by the guest kaiju and getting much too shallow an exploration. I feel like, to me at least, there literally isn't room enough in this town for the both of them, or in this case, in this film. I can also see how easy it would be to mess up any theoretical sequel. Like, this is a story about memories and traumas, the mind and the heart, relationships, and how they affect us. It would be hard to tell that story twice, and very easy to lose the depth that both the unique world-building storytelling and the cast of characters and their arcs and stories gives you, and to just focus on the shallowest action parts. Like, to me, honestly, doing Pacific Rim right more than once would be an impressive feat. It almost necessarily requires to have no sequels because it is such a unique and specific story that anything else told in that universe almost feels like it can't help but lose the core of what makes this one special, because that story has already been told. I'm not saying it can't be done, but I feel like it would take a stroke of writing genius enough that it would not easily be done.
I totally agree that, you know, as much as I can think all day long about how if they were to make a Godzilla Pacific Rim crossover, like how I would want them to do it. But ultimately, I don't want them to do it. I don't think that would be a very good idea. And yeah, like you said, I just think Godzilla's presence would take away from the characters and everything. And I just remember my brother, like when Pacific Rim Uprising was just still in production or pre-production, and my brother came to me with a rumor that he heard that they were going to put Godzilla in it. I just remember responding to him, "That's stupid." And I still feel like that would be stupid because I don't know, like Godzilla's great, but he doesn't need to be in everything. Like, I would take a Godzilla versus Ultraman. I would accept a Godzilla versus Gamera, but like, that's not the direction that I would personally go. Like, I don't feel like Godzilla needs to invade every other giant monster property, as fun of an idea as it may sound, you know? But I just think that while it may be fun to speculate on how they would do it, I just ultimately would not want to see Godzilla in the Pacific Rim universe.
I agree. I joke about it, and I think it'd be cool, like, on a surface level, but no, I do not want to cross over with Godzilla. It just would not work at all, and I definitely think the combine all the giant monster properties together being a stupid idea is a very I cannot agree with that more. That's something that especially bugs me. It's all these things about, oh, we should put Gamera in the MonsterVerse and all this other stuff. Like, no, let them be their own stories. Don't force them together just to try and make it like a big old universe or whatever. Another behind the scenes thing I love is that Charlie Day was cast on this movie because of a speech he did for the series Always Sunny. And in exchange for that, Guillermo del Toro starred in a couple of the episodes, which I think is just a very funny end result of casting an actor in your blockbuster. Am I the only one who's confused on whether the movie is trying to imply the dinosaurs were proto-kaiju or if the kaiju wiped out the dinosaurs? Because I've been wondering that for a while, and I just want to quickly ask if you guys have an opinion on that.
It sounded to me like they were saying that the dinosaurs were proto-kaiju, which is just so silly. But yeah, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah, I think they just meant that that was like their original version of the kaiju, which isn't a thing that I really like, but it's such a small like thing in the movie that I just kind of don't think about it for more than 2 seconds.
Reading up on what Guillermo del Toro said about the movie, one of the things that interests me is he describes how the movie has what he calls gothic tech, which is like the aesthetic of having this like very old, very rusted and cracked but still working tech. And I really love that aesthetic, and I hope we see more movies like that. Oh yeah, there's one more thing I want to say. I have two more things I want to say. I'm sorry, I'm going to make this stray thought segment very long. But first off, I want to very quickly notice that there's a very common trend of people saying this movie is kind of stupid. And I got to say, I hate it. There is a lot of logic in this movie. Basically, everything you can complain about, I feel like Del Toro and Travis Beckham, is that his name? I hope I got that right. Have a response for it. Like, why do you need two pilots? Because of the strain of the robot. Why do you have to set up robots instead of going down to the breach? Because the kaiju can just destroy anything you put down by the breach or evolve past it and all that. And that it's just kind of like frustrating that this movie feels very like this movie has a set logic, and I hate people write it off as stupid just because big robot and big monster fight.
I mean, I definitely was thinking, why don't they just drop nuclear bombs? Like, sure, they don't hit the rift, but just drop them in the middle of the Pacific whenever a new kaiju comes out. Like, I definitely did think of that. It's like, well, yeah, if you hit them, sure, they can adapt to things, but if you hit them right when they come out of the breach, especially because it's out in the middle of the Pacific where it doesn't matter what the heck you... Well, I mean, eventually radiation would pollute the ocean, yes, but you know what I mean. There are no people nearby. So there are definitely some of those fridge logic things. But for the most part, when I'm watching it, nothing jumped out at me as, you know, other than that, which is one of those, you know, well, if they did that, it would break the movie, and I'm sure there's an in-universe explanation too. But nothing else really jumped out at me as problematic. Like, I didn't think there was anything. They did a good job of justifying why there were two pilots. Everything generally made sense and was well justified. I mean, yeah, okay, the concept of making your giant robots look like humanoids to begin with is just kind of dumb and inefficient, but it's a convention of the genre. So you just got to accept that, or why are you even watching this movie? Beyond that, everything struck me as well justified, so I don't know. I had not heard those complaints, but I would not agree with those complaints.
Yeah, I mean, the like dropping nukes in the ocean every time a kaiju shows up would probably just lead to bad results in that specific spot in the ocean. So I can see why they wouldn't do that. But yeah, I just get deeply, deeply annoyed when people just try to like tear movies apart for not using like real world logic or whatever. Like, it just drives me insane, dude. Like, if I want to experience reality, I'm just gonna like go outside or something. I'm not gonna watch a movie. Like, it drives me insane when people do that.
It really is frustrating. It's just like there's a point where it stops being okay, we're just looking at this from a logical set point. It's just like, I don't like this movie. Here's the reason why. It's not just I don't just like it. It's bad logically and objectively. Ding.
So just in the theme of talking about criticisms about this movie that annoy us, although it's not really a criticism, it's just a comparison. But when people say that this movie is like Transformers versus Godzilla, it drives me crazy because Transformers are not the first giant robots. They just weren't. Giant robots have been around for so long. And if you see a movie with a giant robot in it and you think, oh, this is just Transformers, like...
It's like that tweet, man who's only seen the Boss Baby, the film. I'm getting some real Boss Baby vibes from this.
Yeah.
So dumb. It's, they're different. Aesthetics exist. Genres exist. They are not the same fucking thing.
Absolutely. That is just silly. Transformers are much smaller too. But yeah, the idea of a mech fighting a kaiju predates Transformers by a good long while.
Yeah, like King Kong Escapes came out in 1967. And the Transformers weren't around until the 80s. So, like...
Yeah, it's, this is definitely, you know, an homage, a take on the tropes of the genre. But those tropes are well established and have nothing to do with Transformers. And they have something to do with Godzilla, but only because, you know, he's one of the foundational trendsetters in the genre. So, yes.
Yeah.
Probably the most famous mecha versus kaiju battle did happen with him, but it's not like Transformers versus Godzilla. It's like Mecha Godzilla versus Godzilla. I mean, that's literally already been a thing, so you can't exactly say, oh, this is just a mashup of two things. No, this is a thing that happens in kaiju movies. It was happening in kaiju movies like 40 years before this was made, and this was taking a new spin on that, using that concept to tell a human story. But it wasn't derivative of anything except the genre that it is intentionally exemplifying with a new take on.
Yep, it's just ridiculous.
And my last stray thought is my weirdest one. Reading up on Guillermo del Toro's comments on this film, the thing that struck me the most is how one of his inspirations for this was a sports movie. And how, unintentionally, this is one of probably my favorite sports movie ever made. Because we have Gypsy and Rally, who are the retired veteran who's brought back to play. Pentecost is both the inspiring but tough coach and the famous player playing one last game, then he's going to retire. Mako is the eager newcomer. Chuck is the asshole star quarterback or whatever. There's a big dinner scene where they have an argument. It's a team that's always losing against a team that's always winning. They have the first initial failure, and then they finally get a win before the big game, as it were. Like, what an odd but well-fitting choice.
It is very strange, but I like it.
One last bit that, again, reading on the wiki, I found out we were joking about, oh, well, who knows if those triplets really just couldn't act. It's like when you're trying to get triplets, you take what you can get, whether they're actors or not. You know, just kill them off before they can have any lines. Well, along that same line, actually, apparently Crimson Typhoon was going to have four arms, and the plan was to have it be piloted by female quadruplets. But the casting crew just couldn't find any quadruplets, so they had to change it to triplets.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
So it is funny that and even the Jaeger design itself was just shaped by literally the available casting pool in the area.
I wanted to think how a man in a suit would fit in there. The kaijus are trying to honor the spirit and the feeling of the classical kaiju.
So, guys, who's your MVP of this movie?
I have two. I had one, but I decided I'm going to make it two. My MVPs go to Rinko Kikuchi for playing Mako and Guillermo del Toro for directing the film. They both made this movie. Del Toro made such a beautiful movie with such great scenes. Not even the scenes. He just directed the actors amazingly, and he just made such a beautiful world for it to inhabit. And Rinko, as I said, is one of my favorite protagonists. Plays one of my favorite protagonists in any kaiju movie. They both get it, because they single-handedly, in my opinion, kickstarted this entire kaiju movie renaissance we are living in.
My MVP for this film is Travis Beecham, who created the story and co-wrote the screenplay along with Guillermo del Toro, who of course deserves credit as well, but I also knew he would doubtless be someone else's MVP already. But from the wiki, his contributions seem to have come a lot more in the kaiju aspects and sci-fi concepts, whereas the character ideas, the themes of loss and survivor's guilt and everything that drives the story were Beecham's. And since the story concept and screenplay, the interplay of the characters and their stories was this film's strongest point for me, the man who created them deserves the nod as my MVP for this film.
Similar to Brendan, I have two picks for my MVP, but this is more so because they're kind of a package deal. So my MVP goes to Charlie Day and Bern Gorman, who played Dr. Newt Geisler and Dr. Hermann Gottlieb, respectively. These two characters may not fully make up what the movie is, but to me, they are totally vital to my enjoyment of the movie. I'd still like it if they weren't in it, but I don't believe I would like it anywhere near as much as I do, because these characters are such a blast to watch, and to me, they just really do a great job of embodying the theme of coming together and unity and friendship and all that, you know, because while they spend a huge chunk of their time together bickering, at the end, they come together to finally help save the world. And when they do, it's so satisfying, and it's just such a nice moment between the two of them. And yeah, I think, to me, it's just, this movie just wouldn't be the same without him. So what are our final thoughts on this film?
I mentioned that I felt like this was a film I had forgotten, and in memory probably emphasized the aspects that I found lackluster. Seeing it for the first time since the theaters, I feel like that forgetting was unfair. And while I was not a huge fan of the kaiju designs, feeling at the time that they were kind of samey, lacking the distinctive color palettes and differing designs of Toho kaiju, and I haven't been overawed by much of any of the designs since the Mutos came out, and I generally feel like that extreme distinctiveness of palette has seldom been present in the modern era. So while the look of the new kaiju and diversity of the design used to be a strong selling point in kaiju movies for me, setting aside that expectation as just not being part of the 2010s, 2020s era of kaiju projects, for me at least, allows this entry to take a much greater position of prominence without that counted against it. And I feel like the character story is, much as I love the MonsterVerse films, a lot more engaging than the Godzilla entries we've had lately. Which is said not to slag off on those movies, but to express appreciation for aspects of a film which I had previously undervalued that I think does better than they have. At the start, I felt like the most compelling thing about Pacific Rim was the world it builds. Not necessarily the kaiju or battles with them, but the picture it paints of a world under siege by them. That's what really drew me in. But by the end, I felt it was a lot more about character. This is a story about people framed by kaiju, not as some fans might feel about the genre the other way around. The Jaegers are merely extensions of their pilots. The story is still very much about the people, even when it's the suits in action. And while the monster action certainly means that we're not learning a lot about their relationships while the battle is going on, those remain a through line that is never really out of sight or cut away from. And I enjoy that. Pacific Rim excels in effects with some amazing set pieces, a good score, but especially memorable characters. Again, for me, the giant portions are the least interesting aspect present, although even they are solidly done, if not exceptional. But at the end of the day, while its plot is not especially complex, its characters and their relationships tell a story that draws me in and involves me in the reason for all the action. And that's why I really enjoyed it. This is a worthy entry to me into the kaiju genre that didn't deserve to get upstaged by the end of Godzilla's longest hiatus just a year later, and it definitely deserves a place on any kaiju fan's shelf, and maybe even in among their Godzilla marathons.
Like I was saying, I think this is genuinely such a good movie. I love it to bits. I'll be honest, I had fallen off the kaiju bandwagon when this movie came out. I didn't even know it was going to come out until I read one article that mentioned a movie called Pacific Rim. I was like, oh, weird name. Didn't even know what it was about until a couple of months later I was on YouTube and someone had edited together the trailer with a theme song for the animated 1998 Godzilla series, and it was only then I found out it was a kaiju movie, and I was so happy. And I watched it, fell in love with it, And, well, here I am now, back again to the fans. So I can never thank the movie enough for that. And even all these years later, it still holds up so very, very well. So, yeah, I love it. If you have a chance to watch this, watch it. But don't watch the sequel.
There's no sequel. The sequel doesn't exist.
What sequel?
Exactly.
There is no sequel in Ba Sing Se.
I was going to say that. This is my second favorite of the new era of kaiju films that we're getting. Whether you want to call it a renaissance or not, it's second only to Shin Godzilla in my mind. And even then, I'm still like, maybe I like this one a little more. I haven't quite figured that out. But it doesn't really matter, because both films are great. And I don't know, this one just has a special place in my heart. It was the first new kaiju film I had seen in theaters. And the older I get, the more I watch it, the more I appreciate it. You know, as a kid, as a 14-year-old seeing it in the theater, I was just happy to see big robots punch big monsters in the face with some fun characters. And now I look at it as just like, it's kind of like a really just perfect example of this genre. And maybe aside from the nuclear aspect of the genre, but other than that, it's just a really great example of how in the kaiju genre, or according to some, this falls more into the mech genre, but it doesn't matter, it's both to me. But in the kaiju genre, you can have a film where a giant robot blasts the arm off of a giant monster while at the same time telling a really touching story about love and trust and unity and friendship. And for that, this film just really sits, this film sits among the best in the genre for me. So before we get out of here, as usual, we have listener feedback from Ethan Storang on Facebook. Andrew, would you like to read that out for us?
For our recent episode on Final Wars, Ethan writes, "Another great episode in the books. 35 episodes in, G-Force remains an amazing podcast that's always well worth listening to. I also love Final Wars a lot more than the average fan. While it's far from my favorite, I feel like this movie is so full of enjoyable, hilarious, and campy, both intentional and unintentional, moments it's impossible to dislike. I'm heartened to hear Andrew, Nick, and Brendan largely share my feelings in this regard. The opening credits sequence, both visually and musically, rules. It's just so frenetic, and it really sets the stage for an end of days final conflict. I absolutely love the Gotengo versus Manda scene. My only real gripe with it is that Manda's early destruction means we don't get to finally see Manda fight other kaiju, which I feel would have been really fun to witness. As nice as it is to see Manda coiled around a bridge or the Gotengo, I'd love to see a well-executed kaiju fight featuring Manda someday. I hardly agree with Andrew's assessment of Don Fry's performance as Commander Gordon. While the occasional flat delivery mentioned by Nick may have been an unintentional choice on Don's part, I really feel it's perfect for this steely badass that is absolutely unaffected by these apocalyptic scenarios unfolding around him. Unfortunately, I have to agree that the character of Ozaki doesn't have a whole lot of personality. While I enjoy his arc and his character's latent humanity, everything I like about him is ultimately just a trait that doesn't really inform his actions from scene to scene. He's just sort of there, which is rarely a compliment in the context of a character discussion. Regarding the character who will henceforth be known as X, my read on that was always that he was some sort of already established Japanese celebrity, possibly a singer or actor, who decided to cash in on the rampant excitement and enthusiasm for humanity's new alien partnership by changing his name. Ethan, you can't see it, but I'm sitting here in my bedroom slash attic slash office slash recording studio because COVID makes for strange bedfellows. Ha, literally. And even though I am here all by myself, by habit, I just did the arm gesture when I said X. I don't know why, but there you go. I always love the attempted assassination of the fake Secretary General, especially the needlessly dramatic garb of the would-be assassin, who turned his attempt into a literal cloak and dagger affair. It was a joy to hear you discuss Godzilla's Antarctic Caretakers, largely because nothing sparks more joy in me than hearing people say things I agree with. Hey, what do you know? Me too. I'm irritating that way. Hey, what do you know? Me too. It breaks my heart when Godzilla tortures them every time I watch this. I'd really like to have seen them survive and join in the global relief and celebrations at the end of the film. I agree with all of your positive thoughts regarding Gigan's two redesigns in this movie. Three, if you count the incredible mummified version. My favorite part about him, though, is what an absolute idiot he is. He cuts off his own stupid head in his fight with Mothra, and has time to turn around and slowly wonder what just hit him before his own idiotic head falls off of his body. The comedic timing in that scene is just priceless. I love the idea of Shin Godzilla being billed as a completely separate Godzilla one day. Shin feels different enough, while still respecting Godzilla's origins and character, to be his own thing. Out of every incarnation, I think Shin's the one I'd pick to stand as a separate kaiju. So glad to hear you rag on chubby Anguirus. This thick-necked, beefy boy just doesn't feel enough like my favorite kaiju for me to enjoy him a whole lot, outside of the excellent addition of his new attack. That being said, I absolutely love the Singular Point incarnation, so I think the takeaway is that Final Wars did a bad job on the best kaiju, and they should feel bad. I agree that it's a little disappointing to see all these kaiju appear so briefly, but the only solution would be to make cuts elsewhere. I really don't think this movie should be any longer than it is, and I genuinely can't think of a lot I'd want to cut, James chucking Gamera into the fire notwithstanding. Ultimately, a grand parade through Godzilla's kaiju cast was always going to disappoint on some level, and I'm happy we got what we did. I'm with Nick and Andrew in my feelings regarding Monster X and Kaiser Ghidorah. While I appreciate Kaiser's coloration and think it could have really popped in a different environment, I agree that the four-legged approach was executed in a much cooler way with Death Ghidorah, and he just doesn't bring a lot to the table threat-wise after his transformation. I also agree with Andrew's criticism of the vampire bite. It's great as a one-off, but is disappointing to see used again and again. Apologies to Nick and Brendan, but I hate this Godzilla design. He just looks like a rat, and I can't unsee it. I can't agree with you enough about the soccer scene. It's one of my least favorite scenes in kaiju cinema, and it's baffling to me that it made it to the final cut. So many people, from conception to execution, had to really consider it and ultimately decide it was worthy of inclusion. That absolutely baffles me. I'm so glad I'm not the only one who's noticed Johnny Johnny. I see that every single time I watch Final Wars, and I kind of just fixate on it during any scene in which the list of names is visible behind Gordon. I'm going to join in with two MVPs of my own, Don Fry and Akira Takarada. The Secretary General and Commander Gordon steal every single scene they're in, and I love both characters so much. This movie could be absolutely terrible, and I'd still watch it regularly for their appearances alone. As much as I will miss your Zone Fighter episodes, I am really looking forward to hearing another discussion from G-Force. And the subject matter looks to be a good inspiration for a great episode. This has been Ethan, and I think it's a straight-up crime that Titanosaurus was omitted from Final Wars.
Once again, thank you so much, Ethan. We always love hearing your feedback, as I say, every episode. And we just really, really appreciate that you have stuck with us for as long as you have so far. That means more to us than we could probably put into words. So thank you so much for still being here after all this time. So if you would like to send us feedback, you can find us on Twitter at GForce Kaiju Pod, Instagram at GForce Kaiju Pod, Facebook at facebook.com/GForceKaijuPod, or you can just go on Facebook and type into the search bar GForce Kaiju Podcast, and you can email us at GForceKaijuPod@gmail.com. And we do have links to all of those in the description of each episode. Also, if you would like to leave a review for us on Apple Podcasts, we would appreciate that very much. We will read any feedback and reviews we get on the show. So if you have something you want to say to us, go ahead and say it.
So last time, we explored the character of Godzilla. What made it popular and enduring? What defined it for us?
And next time, we are going to give the same treatment to Gamera. So please join us for what we hope will be another free-flowing discussion episode.
So to close us out, we will each be going around saying, if we had our own Jaeger, what would we name it?
This has been Andrew, and I would just make a terrible second-generation kind of knockoff of Gypsy Danger and call it War Ready.
This has been Brendan, and I'll catch you guys in Emerald Thunder.
I've been Nick, and I'll be beating down Kaiju in a black and purple Jaeger called Phantom Eclipse. Oh, also, Brendan.
Yes.
We came up with our idea for the sign-off thing.
Yes.
And just to give you time to think of it, because I know I need time to think of it, it's what if you had your own Jaeger, what would you name it?
Oh my God, that is actually funny. I was actually going to suggest that if you guys didn't have a sign-off. So, I like it.
All right, cool. Yeah,
we're 3 for 3.
Yeah, we all have the same idea. Okay, I have a response, but I'm going to turn off my AC. I thought I had an AC break, but your good points just... they just require a response. Like, dropping nukes in the ocean every time a kaiju shows up would probably just lead to... fucking motorcycle.
Shoot. I just realized. How do we do a Zone Fighter finale and not do an MVP for the Zone Fighter series? It's so obvious. How did we miss that?
How? Oh my God.
I feel so stupid.
Oh, me too.